When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hi, I'm Phil Craig.
And I'm Andrew Loney.
And together we aim to bring you the most scandalous stories and some of the most scandalous people in history. So thanks for joining us here on the Scandalmongers podcast.
Well, lots of developments this week on some of the stories that we first brought you last year. It shows we have our finger on the pulse.
Don't we just? Goodness me. Well, it's 12th night as well. It's the end of the festive season. I'll be taking down my grotto.
Right.
My decorations will come down later, but I've still enjoyed the last of the Ferrero Rocher.
Oh, good. That's we'll good. Have to wait till next year, until later this year, to see you in your Christmas cap again.
And my lovely morning coffee in my Scandalmongers mug. Excellent.
So I hope everyone's been getting their mugs.
Well, do you know, we've had quite a lot of feedback. You know, the last show did really well, and a lot of people wanted to wish us a Happy New Year. It's so nice to be, engaged with viewers and listeners like this. This is my current favourite podcast. Says Elizabeth Basford, to which many people replied, mine too, which was rather nice. Rev D. Wendy said, mine too. Davina Wilson, 58, mine three. Rail Douglas, if I'm pronouncing her right, sent us best wishes from Australia. Lots of nice messages. Alison Kent says she's got her mug in the great state of Victoria. So that's nice.
Good. Well, I mean, I've certainly also been corresponding with people on Twitter and things, and it is nice. We're creating a sort of community of listeners and a community of speakers too, as people come back for the second or third time. I think we're hoping to have Laura Thompson back on Agatha Christie.
Well, we had a little surge of subscriptions yesterday. I think this is connected to you talking to your friend Andrew Gold on his podcast, because I think a lot of people sort of saw you, and I think you must have mentioned us, because we had about 200 new subscriptions. So it's a good time to remind people, if you like what we do, or tolerate what we do even, it's really important, as all YouTubers always say, please keep liking the shows, subscribe if you can, spread the word if you can, and share us around. We're here to be shared.
Yeah, well, you know, we've got some really good speakers coming up. I think one of the things that people like is the fact that we do seem to get these very top-level people to talk to us, and we have a particularly top-level person today.
Yes, we have. We have Tina Brown, who is a genuine get, which is a word she would have used many times in her career. Before we get to Tina, though, I think we should upsum a couple of things. As you said at the beginning, two of the stories, in fact, that we covered have become front page sensations, really.
Yep.
Not only in Britain in recent days. Obviously, the Epstein affair. Now, you've been digging into that for your book. But it's all over the papers this morning. And also just more and more revelations. And ominous things for Andrew, I'd say, and for the royal family, you know. First of all, Maxwell contradicts Prince Andrew's claim that she introduced him to Epstein. Prince Andrew had daily massages at Epstein's house, former housekeeper claimed. And then at the bottom, I thought really significant, this is the Telegraph today, the in-house newspaper of the Conservative Party. Starmer says Met police should look at Prince Andrew abuse allegations.
Yes.
That's quite a thing.
Well, and Di Davis, who we've had on the show, the former head of Royal Security, has also called for that. I mean, I've been calling it for a long time, but of course been ignored. But I think with these new allegations coming forward and more support for what Virginia Giuffre said, I think it's strengthening her case, which has always, with some people, been disputed. He's in big trouble. And who knows? We've got many more of these depositions still to be opened. And who knows what's inside them? I think it was very foolish of the royal family to let him walk to church the other day. They should be keeping this story absolutely, he should be totally out of sight.
That's interesting because for Starmer to say this, for people who may not know, he's the leader of the Labour Party, the opposition. He's, you know, 90% certain probably to be Prime Minister this year at some point. Former Director of Public Prosecutions, like Britain's main lead prosecutor. For him to come out that strongly, remember, he'll be sitting down with King Charles every week. That's part of his job. And getting on with the royal family is part of his job. And using them as a diplomatic tool is part of his job. So if he's basically saying the king's brother now should face a British police investigation, you know, and you wonder the politics of that. You know, he's been accused of sort of being quite soft and moderate by the more kind of radical side of his own party. Maybe this is what issue he feels he can be quite aggressive on.
Well, it's one of the points that Clive Irving raised when we spoke to him, that a Labour government may be less sympathetic towards the royals. They'll be looking, for example, at the cost of their protection, the question of their houses, and actually whether they're really good value for money. And I think what struck me over the last few days is the anti-monarchy feelings, which are clearly appearing on social media. And certainly people that I know who would be traditionally rather establishment like me are much more questioning of the monarchy. I mean, I've always only ever gone after the rogue royals, but there's a sense now that they're all tainted with Andrew. They need to distance themselves. I mean, I think the two issues that I take some issue with, one is that he should be giving cooperating with the police and the allegations that Giuffre made about being trafficked. I mean, the crime isn't that he slept with her. The crime is that she was trafficked and he was aware of that. And I think the other is that, you know, that he's going to be evicted from Royal Lodge. But Royal Lodge, he has a legitimate lease on. He's paid for the upkeep. The optics don't look good, but I think there would be very little, a few grounds to kick him out. He just needs to go of his own volition. And I think this is the problem. For his status and his pride, he's going to stay there.
Gosh. Well, I want to say a few words in your defence, Andrew, because you got a bit of a kicking on social media after your interview with that man, Gold. People were saying, how can this man, Andrew Lowney, be a monarchist and still be exposing all these terrible things the royals do? And some wise figure on Twitter, I think he was called Phil Craig, leapt to your defence.
Yes, I did. Thank you.
To say, well, that's one of the things about Andrew that's so great.
He is very odd.
he's extremely unpredictable and strange. No, he doesn't necessarily go with what you'd expect. He looks at stories. We all try and look at stories on their own merits. It reminded me of that thing about COVID. A lot of people dismissed the lab leak because Trump said it. Well, so what if Trump said it?
Exactly. Well, and also, if you remember that one of the people who investigated the special forces abuses in Australia, and the man who was doing that, you know, was actually someone who had a very good relationship with the Australian Army and was very supportive of them.
Yep, our good friend Chris Masters.
So, you know, I don't think we, you know, you can still support an institution while still believing that there's some rotten apples in it that need to be weeded out. I mean, I think anyone who supports an institution would support that. It's not good for the institution to have them.
The other thing I would like to say, people complain about using the word sleep with or have sex with when actually we are talking about abuse, allegations of abuse. But there is a word beginning with R that you're not really supposed to say on YouTube. It'll have your
It'll be taken down. Yes, I hadn't realized that. That just seems odd.
Maybe I've misunderstood, but I believe from what other podcasts have told me that also that certain German regime from the 1930s, if you mentioned that, you get into special measures.
Right. We don't want that. We don't want that. So that's our best behavior.
We're not in any way soft soaping what's being alleged about Andrew at all. It's really serious. And it seems to be getting more serious.
Yes, absolutely. No. I mean, I, you know, as you know, I've been slightly sitting on the fence on certain issues to do with him sexually. I think financially, there's a very strong argument against his behavior. But I think as these depositions get released, and thank goodness the judge has agreed to do so after pressure from the media, these things would have remained secret without, brave journalists fighting to have them released.
Indeed, it's been a great week for brave journalists. And the other one I'd love to talk to is, again, I've actually just emailed him, is Nick Wallace.
Yep.
Our friend on the post office scandal. A huge story now in Britain, maybe not so much outside Britain, but what revelations. And there's a BBC drama that everybody's watching, and it's very moving and extremely enraging about the injustice. Nick talked about it on our show, 6 months ago?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the biggest miscarriages of justice. I mean, there are now fraud charges being levelled at the post office. But why did it take a television programme to do this? I mean, Private Eye had been running with this story. We've covered it, and nothing happened. So it shows you the power of television to basically get the establishment to actually do the right thing.
Yeah, all of a sudden it's become something that there are not just headlines at the front of the paper, serious and angry leader columns in the middle of the paper from the editorial teams, from both the Times and the Telegraph, which are the papers the government read, and the Guardian, which is the paper that the new government will probably read.
Yeah,
and there's quite a lot of anger about the way that this went on for, even now the compensation deals have not been agreed.
They're not being paid. People have gone on to be given fresh honours. Their careers have not been curtailed. The woman who was in charge of the post office and should have fallen on her sword has refused to return some of the honours she received. I mean, it stinks.
Her position looks really, really bad now, and I'm sure she will have to give back the honours. But also, there's a politician in Britain, Ed Davey, who is in real trouble over this. I think he could lose his job. He's the leader of the Liberal Party, smallest party, Lib Dems, they're called now. Smallest party in Parliament, but still significant, and could be very significant at the election.
Exactly. Well, I mean, there's talk of a Lib-Lab pact, and I think if he's gone, or if the Libs have been discredited by this, it's not going to help them.
No, well, because he was the minister at the time in what was called the coalition government with the Tories and the Liberals at the beginning of the century, and after 2010, and he, it would appear, was very dismissive of these people when they first tried to raise the miscarriage of justice, and it's come out to bite him now.
Yeah, good. I'm glad. I mean, it's just shocking that how people in power really don't use that power properly. They use it to maintain their positions and to cover up scandals. So that's why we have the scandalmongers, to hold them to account.
Well, indeed. And also, we're very lucky to talk to people like Nick, who really have spent years exposing stories. And you'll know similar people. And you are indeed yourself one who are exposing stories on Epstein and other royals. So more power to their investigative pens as we steam into 2024. But Tina Brown.
Yeah, well, she's another one who has had an interesting position because she, in some ways, mixes socially with many of the people she writes about. But that doesn't stop her actually criticizing them and having some pretty sharp things to say, not least about Prince Andrew and other royals. And I think you have a particular bond with her because you've both written on Princess Diana.
Yes, I got to know Tina through that and also through a few films I made that were screened in America, and she was very gracious enough to host those events, which were amazing. She was the queen. I mean, she still is extremely influential, but for a while, she was the most significant media figure, certainly in print, maybe in all media in the US. You know, a British transplant, she went there very young. She made Vanity Fair into the kind of cultural force that it was in the 80s and 90s. Mixing up kind of high-class gossip with the proper investigative and foreign reporting, beautiful writing from top, top writers. My old friend Christopher Hitchens used to be part of her stable of friends and writers. Anthony Holden was another, but lots of people. An incredible work for her.
No, I mean,
and she also had a sense of the zeitgeist, which is a word I think she uses a lot.
She's had a long career at the top and has managed in some ways to survive in a pretty ruthless world. And I think it's quite a coup to have her. And I think a lot of people wanted to have her on the show. So, you just need to ask and we can provide.
We can certainly try. All right. Well, that's a rather elongated introduction. Should we go and try and find Tina in some Manhattan cocktail bar?
Let's do that. And I think what we can also promise you is something on Epstein in the coming weeks.
Yes, we're going to do more on Epstein, and fingers crossed, maybe go back to the post office scandal too, either as a whole programme or half a programme.
Yep, that would be great.
All right. Thanks to everybody for listening. See you soon.
See you soon. Bye.
Hello, Tina.
Good morning.
I want to start with a trip down memory lane. Do you remember this photograph? These two handsome young people?
Good Lord. Is that you?
Yes. You haven't changed. I think I have.
Yeah. God knows. I don't recognise myself even more, but how nice to be reminded of that.
As is appropriate for you, I think, one of my favourite New York memories was the night you hosted a gala screening for me for a film I'd made, and very generous took me out for lunch or was it dinner in Bryant Park.
What fun it was.
Great night.
I'm so pleased. Well, come back. Not sure I can lay on quite such a spread in these days of different budgets.
Well, the other time you met was in the Carlisle Hotel a couple of years later, and you gave me some very good advice. It was in Diana's favourite bar, I think, Bemelman's Bar. And we were talking about your Diana book, because I'd previously done one. And you said, Phil, you need an American agent. And I didn't take your advice. And that's why you're still having cocktails in that bar, and I'm doing this podcast.
Oh, I don't think so. Well, listen, not too late. What's happened since then?
Yes, well, you were really going to discuss how, in some ways, the image of Diana perhaps has changed in the last few years, since perhaps Phil's book and even since your own book. I mean, do you feel that in the War of the Whales is that things are a bit more balanced now?
I'm so sorry. I've lost your picture. Just a second. Let me just... Oh, here you go. Sorry. Do you want to just take that again?
Yes. I mean, since Phil's book and indeed your book, do you think that the public perception of Diana has changed?
It's very interesting, isn't it, how she keeps living on so potently in the public imagination. I think there has been more complexity added. I think, you know, people understanding that the Martin Bashir interview happened under so much stress for her, I think does change people's sense a little bit of her going so neurotically sort of off track, essentially, in those last years of her life. Although I'm of the opinion that Diana still said in that interview everything that she wanted to say. And I'm actually also of the opinion she would have given an interview to somebody else. She was sort of looking to unload all that. But perhaps it wouldn't have been at quite such a sort of bridge-burning voltage that it was if she hadn't been under the kind of illusion that there were all of these people spying on her. And, of course, the fact that, you know, we never really understood why she fired suddenly Patrick Jefferson and the terrible incident where she went up to Tiggy Leg Burke at a Christmas party and said, you know, sorry about the baby, that all sounded like she had gone so, crazy, essentially. But, of course, now we understand she'd been told Tiggy Leg Burke, you know, had aborted a child by Charles, and that she had been told Patrick Jefferson was her chief spy. So it is more understandable. So, yes, I do think there is quite a lot of, you know, more nuance has been added to the last year's pictures, at any rate, of Diana.
I'd like to get your view on Charles, actually, and the job, what he's doing with the job, because I'm sure, like me, you probably thought one time he wouldn't perhaps be the best of kings, as Diana herself thought. But to be fair, I've always been a bit of a Republican, if I'm honest. I seem to have done a surprisingly good job. Apart from the odd bit of temper, the Windsor temper, he seems to have done a reasonable job. What do you think?
Well, actually, I always thought Charles was a lot more interesting than people kind of said, and that he might be fine, depending on when the Queen went. I mean, she hung on and on. She didn't do what Queen Margaret has just done in Denmark and say, you know what, it's enough. But he is doing superbly well. I think what did surprise me was just the ease of the transition. I mean, when I was contemplating the Queen's death at the as I was writing the Palace Papers, I really thought there was going to be a period of huge instability after the Queen died in terms of the public's sense of the monarchy. That he completely forestalled. I mean, it was such a smooth transition. It was so beautifully handled by him, aside from the snit about a pen, which, you know, God, all of us do that stuff. He really was just amazing. He hit every note right. And of course, I think a lot of that's to do with Camilla in his life. You know, I think she's so stabilized him at this point that he can focus on the job instead of the endless kind of hand-wringing and, you know, Eeyore-like sort of, feeling the world hates him and all that stuff that made him so much less sympathetic than he is now.
I mean, you seem very much like an Edward the Seventh. I mean, you know, that his reputation will grow and grow, and he will achieve something.
I think he will, as a matter of fact. You know, Charles is always, in a sense, unlucky. I mean, you know, his sort of Eeyore-like maxim was always, oh, just my luck. You know, he always sort of felt something would get in the way. Every time he went abroad, one of the, you know, and was going to make some big speech, one of the kids came up with some horrendous, you know, hair on fire incident that completely eclipsed him, etc. If he gets enough time, and, you know, hopefully his health will stay good, if he gets another 5 good years, I think he's going to be very, very sort of well-remembered and rather tenderly sort of missed, actually, because of his decency, actually. Because, I mean, because his sort of faithful adherence to his things he cares about has turned out to be so prescient. I mean, the world has come round to Charles's point of view on so many things that he suddenly looks like the great prophet. And he stuck to it, you know. And he stuck to it in unfashionable moments. He was mocked a lot for his obsessions with, you know, organic gardening and climate change and, you know, why aren't we thinking more about the Marsh Arabs and all the things he cared about? But they were all very good things to be caring about. And I think he's won a lot of world respect for that. He's much respected now, really, as a statesman, which, you know, seemed impossible at one point.
Well, I guess from the British perspective, we've had so many leaders, political leaders, falling out with each other, with their own parties, coming and going, sometimes laughably quickly, that the sense that we need a royal family for some kind of stability. And then he pops up in Germany speaking German, and people are thinking, we've not really seen this Charles before very much. So
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Like you're so right about that. I mean, in a funny way, the instability that I thought would happen when the Queen died was actually the instability in the political system, not in the monarchy. And in fact, it was lucky for Charles, really, that he became king against a backdrop of absolute mayhem in Westminster, which kind of made him seem like this grown-up in the room, the man who could host that wonderful reception when the Queen died, in which every leader was there. And he's known them all for so long. You know, he has these long, deep relationships. He knew their predecessors and their predecessors and their predecessors, and he knows their relatives, and he knows that, you know, he's just been on the scene. There's nothing like connections. It's like he's a bit very similar to Joe Biden in that regard, you know, who can pick up the phone to leaders that he's just known so many years. It's an asset.
Well, that was the biggest challenge he's had to handle, is his the breakdown in the relationship with his son and William and Harry at Daggers. Do you feel there's any hope there for a reconciliation? And do you think America could help drive that? Because the picture we get here from America is that Harry and Meghan are not quite as popular perhaps as they were a year or so ago, and that maybe they would need to reach out.
Well, I think they do. Whether they can at this point is the issue, right? I mean, I think I would say to say they're unpopular in America is more sort of emotionally coloured than it is, really. I think there's just a kind of lack of interest in them, really, except in perhaps fashion moments or, you know, celebrity moments. There really isn't a great deal of interest in either of them. And that's, of course, pretty deadly if your currency is now going to be celebrity heat, which is what foolishly they put their faith in. So they actually do need their connection with England very much. I would argue, though, losing Harry was a big loss for the British monarchy. And I know he's not popular in England, but they need him. I mean, the fact is that there are just not enough royal ambassadors of any popularity to send out onto the scene. So Charles's great sort of endless cri de coeur about, quote, slimming down the monarchy, he got it slimmed down big time in ways that he didn't anticipate. And, you know, lost two big key players, of course, in Andrew, who, although never popular, at least you could send him out to be a blowhard at a dinner in uniform, you know. Whereas Harry was and is, he does have a great touch with the public. I mean, he's a really good communicator. And frankly, to have been able to send him off on world tours and stuff was absolutely marvelous, you know, if he'd played ball. So there is a loss there. I also do feel William, a great sadness in William, actually. I mean, you know, you talk about the you talked about the change in perception of Diana. I actually think the crown was very helpful in a way to William, because I think it showed what Spare, of course, very, I thought, callously, ignored, which was William's pain at the death of his mother. You know, Harry's book was all about Harry being, you know, his mother, his pain, his loss. It was a terrible thing that happened. And of course, as the youngest, Harry was, you know, terminally sort of wounded by it. But, you know, William suffered too, obviously, greatly. And somehow Spare didn't allow for that. They somehow didn't credit him with that. And, you know, he went through hell. And I think that it was good, I think, to remind people. So although they hate the crown, the royals, actually, I think it's done a huge amount to humanize them and help them. And I think particularly for William, who was beginning to get that air of sort of, you know, the public, although they say they like him a lot, you know, they also think he's perfect. He's like, he's the one who, you know, is just the sort of the ho-hum one who does all the stuff he's supposed to do. And obviously that's not as interesting as the kind of tribulations of Harry. But I think that the crown made you feel actually there's a lot going on between, you know, below the surface with William, and he deserves our empathy as well as our, you know, respect, essentially.
It isn't one of the tropes that actually it's women coming into the royal family, whether it's Queen Mother or Kate or Camilla, who are not necessarily royal, who are the ones who, in a sense, make their partners feel loved.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's Burrow.com/ACAST. Burrow.com/ACAST.
Actually bring a little bit of common sense. And they've been the ones who have been popular, actually.
Well, that's true. And obviously, Kate has been the most remarkable success and is a huge, huge asset to William. But what Harry brought, and when I was researching the palace papers, I got this from some very close people to William. Harry also was a great help to William in his prior days because he was the kind of... He was the best friend. He was the person that could talk, William could talk to without any inhibitions. The only other person on the planet who'd gone through what William had gone through. It gave them a special kind of secret society almost. So, and he could laugh at William and it would bring William out of his rather serious sort of sometimes pompous self. Being not having anyone to prick that bubble in his life as Harry used to do. I mean, his people close to him feel that's a loss for William. And you can only imagine, given that they had this wonderful kind of solidarity about what they both shared and their hatred of the press, how traumatic it was for William to then find that Harry, of all people, had become the person to spill all the beans and to, you know, take all that stuff to the media and air their dirty laundry. Absolutely traumatic for him, which is why, to get back to your earlier question, it's not easy for William to accept Harry back in the family. I think that he is very, very wounded and his father will want him back. But I just don't know whether William will ever, ever have the trust. And if you don't have the trust, it's very hard to have someone like that back into the family fold.
We were talking to somebody, I'm sure you know, Clive Irving, a few weeks ago from the Daily Beast, who was making the excellent point, I think, that, you know, there's very likely going to be a new government. It'll probably be a Labour government. Keir Starmer is Prime Minister. If he was advising Starmer, Clive said he would say, make the royal family get Harry and Meghan back. Britain generally has a problem. The royal family is a really big problem with its image, with the legacy of slavery, with the empire.
Yeah.
Whatever the rights and wrongs of this, whether there are petty arguments behind the scenes or whatever, it just is a really bad look to have driven away the one woman of colour who ever joined the family.
Well, absolutely. I think it is. So I think they desperately need her. But is she going to play ball? That's what they're going to worry about. You know, it's a great idea if they play ball, not if they're an endless distraction with, resentments and so on and, you know, criticisms and all the rest. But yes, I think that Meghan would have absolutely superb ambassador for England and the one it sorely needs, as you say, with the diversity such an issue, frankly, for the royals.
What interests me, you talked about spilling the beans. I mean, you've talked to 120 people for the Palace Papers. I mean, people who don't normally speak to royal biographers. I mean, is it because you know them socially that you were able to do it? I've heard you talk about how you just persist and keep asking people. And doesn't it also cause you problems? Because in some ways, you know, one moment you may be having dinner with them and the next you're having to write about them.
Well, I mean, I do know a lot of people in that circle, and I count some of them as, you know, people I've known for many years. So there's a level of trust. I'm always very careful in my handling of contacts. And once people know that you're not going to burn them, they are willing to talk to you over the years. You know, having written Diana Chronicles, having, you know, frankly, followed the royals since the 80s, I do have a lot of relationships in those circles. So it's really more about that. And I frankly, you know, I think I get it right. So actually, I don't get blowback from those people that I talk to because they know that I've represented what they said truthfully and I haven't burned them in the process. So I think it's all about how you handle it, actually. And I'm sure both of you who've done all this kind of work, it's the same situation.
And why do they talk? I mean, do they want the story out? Do they want the truth told?
I think that they like talking to someone who they think is going to really position it in the way, that, you know, the context of it, and is not just looking for that sort of sensational bite. It often means, of course, you do get the sensational bite because nothing makes people more willing to sort of let their guard down and really tell you things if they do feel that kind of trust. So, I think that they talk because they want, deep down, people kind of want to see people they know represented in the way that they should be and or can be. But even if it's not always the most positive reading, at least it's the truthful reading. Because, I mean, there's just so much. I mean, one of the things that I found in writing both books, and I'm sure it's been the same for both of you, that is just so much garbage written. I mean, that you know, when you start to really do the fact-checking and you call the people and you try to check things out with other sources, you find that half the incidents that are in, you know, the accounts, half the time they're not even there. I mean, one of the cases in point was a much-repeated fact. I mean, it's not a massively important one, but it's just an example. In every story about Tom Markle, it writes about how he won the lottery, right? He had a lottery win of about 500,000. So I was talking to Tom Markle and I said to him, like, you know, what an amazing thing it must have been when you won the lottery. I mean, that must have been like so transformative for you. He said, I never won the effing lottery. You know, I said, what? I said, it's in every account that you won the lottery. So I have no idea. He said, maybe my son was like having somebody. I never won the lottery. Do I look like a guy who won the lottery? And I just thought, how absolutely amazing. I mean, that's now appeared in like every news account and that ever writes about him, you know, in terms of a biography and every book. But, you know, it wasn't true. So it's like you think that makes you, that freaks you out, actually, because you start thinking, well, what can I trust, actually? So that's why I get so kind of, you know, anal about sort of going deep and trying to find other ways to confirm things.
And do you ever feel you've been played by them, that there's a narrative they're trying to create, or you have to pull your punches?
Because of course. No, I don't feel I have to pull my punches, but I do know when I'm being spun, obviously. And, you know, you take that into account. And there's usually a nugget you can take out of that, but doesn't necessarily mean you're going to go with the angle.
And do you feel that there needs to be more openness with Royal Archives, which is a concern of mine, that, you know, you have them leaking the most personal information from months ago, and yet we can't look at files that are 100 years old?
Absolutely. I think it's incredible. I mean, I salute your quest to do that. I know you've spent a lot of money on it. I mean, I think it's outrageous. There are so many of these files that are closed. I mean, why can't we hear what, you know, why don't we know what Prince Philip and the Queen's will is? You know, honestly, let's just see the wills. I mean, there's so much a part of sort of the public. I mean, the public has had such an investment in them. We need to know where the money, you know, what happened to the money and where it went. And I think we should know. And I think that the archives definitely should be open. I mean, the constant sort of, let's hear the whole World War II story and stop trying to protect who was a Nazi secretly or whatever. History is history, and we need to know the full story. And I know that Charles is opening the archives to research the sort of history of slavery. Well, you know, it ain't going to be pretty. We know that, but it's certainly better. You cannot keep in today's world, particularly as we're coming into the era of like AI and open source and all the stuff we have and the way of getting leaks, and you're not going to be able to keep the secrets, is the truth. So it's far better to sort of, you know, to put it out there, in its historical framework and deal with it.
I mean, as you said, I mean, I've been pushing for this for a long time, but it's very hard to get historians to support that, because I think a lot of them are worried that they'll lose their access. Lobby system. And I think there's also, I suppose, a debate about where the private life crosses into the public life and whether we're entitled to cross over that boundary.
I tend to think that when it comes to the monarchy, this is history and we need to know. And even if we don't know 10 years after their death, we've still got to be able to know at a certain point. It informs our view of so much that's beyond them, you know, and we need to be able to know the true stories. I think it's all part of the transparency of history that we need, that you can only, helps us with our knowledge and our understanding of these people.
And do we have the full story about Andrew, do you think? I mean,
no and yes. I mean, I think, you know, we all know that Andrew, you know, he had no judgment. I mean, one of the things we forget about these royals is they are very naive, and that includes Charles. I mean, the whole story of Charles receiving bags of cash, you know, from that Emirati, you know, thing for his charity. I mean, it was stunning. There is a naivety to the royals. I mean, why would they not be royal and be naive? I mean, they're surrounded in people who laugh at their jokes, who tell them they're wonderful. They never meet anybody who hasn't, you know, who's not bowing or scraping or flattering or like wants something from them. I mean, who wants to be around a royal, honestly, unless it's to enhance their own reputation, which means that perhaps their reputation is in need of enhancing. So you have a sort of built-in hazard there, which is people want to kind of greenwash, as it were, crown wash their reputations by hanging out with the royals a lot of the time. So I would say about 80% of the people around them who are not their sort of very, you know, inborn set, which is why, of course, they trust those people more, really want to get to know the royals for some reason of not particularly hygienic reasons. So I think that, and they're very, very naive. And I mean, the case of Andrew, unfortunately, he had that, he's very dumb, and all of his life he's been told, you know, he's interesting or intelligent or all the things we know he isn't. So he has no judgment at all about himself. And he just, you know, he's got the worst judgment, and he's always felt he doesn't have enough money. And may ask, well, he seems to have a very nice house and, you know, certainly a decent stipend and people would kill for it. However, you know, he's constantly in circles with people who have a lot more. And it just rankles with them that they don't have the freedom. It's also pretty demeaning to be so infantilized as he was, where he has to ask his brother, he has to ask his mother. I mean, what men of 50s and 60s, you know, could tolerate the way they have to go cap in hand to their own families for sort of their stipend or to the government? I mean, not having your own money is a very humiliating thing.
But they have trust funds. I mean, you know.
They do, but those trust funds are usually very tied up and very administered, and it's a stipend. It's like, you know, it's something we'd all love, right? But from their point of view, they're mixing in circles where people have much more money, have private planes, have all these things, have freedom, and they just, it just rankles. I mean, you see it with them again and again. And in the case of Andrew, you know, he's very naive. I mean, he was bedazzled essentially by the whole Jeffrey Epstein world. I mean, this big time financier who paid attention to Andrew as if he was important and had dinner parties in his big house in New York and invited all these sort of people that Andrew could never have met on his own. So he was very, very naive. And he's, you know, and he's like a 15-year-old when it comes to sort of, you know, sexual sort of, you know, appetite. You know, he just wants, you know, big breasted cocktail waitresses, you know, and that's who he is. And so he was such a mark, you know, for Epstein, such a terrible mark. In that sense, you almost feel sorry for him, not completely.
But you saw through all this. I mean, you were invited to one of these dinner parties, weren't
yes.
you?
And yes, you, and you, I'm proud to say I declined.
Exactly, exactly. You worked yes. it out.
Well, but you know, frankly, I mean, I'm much more able to judge whether someone's a fraud than Prince Andrew ever was. It stuns me, though, that his own people didn't and said, this is really a dangerous invitation. That's the part that stuns you. But I think a lot of the time, you know, don't forget, they appoint the people. So they appoint people who aren't necessarily very smart either.
Well, I mean, I was told by one of the protection officers that, you know, if he raised things, his boss would say, well, do you want to go back on the beat in Brixton? And so they took a blind eye on things.
Well, that's pretty ugly.
Yeah. How about Fergie? I mean, what's her reputation now in the States?
Well, she was never disliked, Fergie. I like Fergie. I mean, I think she's a warm-hearted sort of Calamity Jane, essentially. I mean, she has terrible judgment about people. But she's a very warm person and I think a rather decent woman, actually. And funnily enough, I think she's coming into her own in a strange way. I think that people will be very fond of Fergie by the end. And I think that she was brutally treated by Prince Philip, absolutely brutally treated. I think it was absurd to cast her out in the way that they did. And I think kind of tragic that their marriage essentially ended because of it, because clearly she has been the most loyal wife anyone could ever ask for. And stuck by Andrew when no one else wanted to, for which, you know, you've got to say, okay, well, she's a very loyal woman, a good judgment.
But her status comes from being still the Duchess of York. And, I mean, you could argue that she's exploited her royal position to make money for herself.
She has. Absolutely, she has. But then again, what else did she have to exploit? You know, why would you ever hire her unless she was the Duchess of York? I mean, that's just a fact. So, I mean, that's just the way she wants to continue to live in the way that she thinks that she's entitled. And therefore, she needs a big chunk of change. And the only thing she's got to leverage, essentially, is being the Duchess of York. And she has. And lesser folk have done the same, you know, in the world of celebrity.
But it doesn't help the image of the monarchy. I mean, Sarah Chatto and others have quietly gone off and done their own thing. And no, you know, they don't hit the newspapers. You know,
yeah, but they weren't discarded by their husbands. And she has a fair bit of money herself. You know, Fergie got terrible terms in her divorce. Terrible terms. I mean, because she has no judgment, her lawyer seems to have been hopeless. And she got a very, very bad divorce. She didn't even get a house of her own for life. She just got, like, use of a house. You know, so she made a really bad deal. And she was, and then of course she was wildly profligate and absurdly, you know, she spent absurd amounts of money. So she has no judgment. So you've got two people really with no judgment. But in the case of Sarah, I think she has a generous heart.
And what's Andrew's future then? I mean, how do they deal with him? Do they lock him up?
As we're speaking, you know, we're soon, maybe by the time this goes out, they will have already released a new flood of emails from, you know, new flood of information from Jeffrey Epstein, which is going to be unlocked, and we may see far worse things. I mean, Andrew behaved absurdly badly, and, you know, he forever pay for it. What they do with Andrew, I think, rather depends on what this next round of Epstein revelations shows us. I think that he's finished as a public figure, but, you know, he'll just sort of live out his days at Royal Lodge. And the only person who really wants to talk to him is his horse, as far as I can see. you know, and that's the way it will be. But I think he'll still be sort of in the family circle on shooting holidays and things. And he'll have his own, you know, sort of small, you know, dullard circle. And it's a question of whether he can just sort of live with that in a graceful way. I mean, I think he's very unhappy. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, that has been really the price he will pay for being so having such bad judgment and such you know, such foolish tastes.
But not a role, for example, in the Middle East or in Asia, perhaps, you know, quietly behind the scenes, some sort of selling arms or whatever.
No. I don't think Andrew will ever be trusted in any kind of public position again. Definitely not. In this world of transparency, there is just no way you can risk Andrew galloping around making those kind of mistakes.
Well, I'm conscious we only have you for a few more minutes, but I wanted to do a bit of a swerve in the conversation because we're all sitting here trying to get our heads around the American presidential election this year. And another name that could well be released today or in the next few days on the Epstein list is Donald Trump, although he seems invulnerable. His popularity seems invulnerable to anything. Do we have to prepare ourselves to see him back in the White House, or is there another way?
I think there's a very strong possibility, I do, that he'll be back. He is the front runner by a long margin, you know, big margin as the Republican nominee. And then it's a question of whether the American electorate is really going to elect someone who has, you know, over 90, you know, charges against him. and might, you know, be in prison at the time of the presidential election, although that's very unlikely. You know, it really is about whether Biden can kind of muster the excitement of the Democratic young at this point, I think, to vote him back, because he's lost a great deal of support from the young over his Palestinian position. And he is considered very much too old. And it's possible that Biden, far from being the only one who can beat Biden, is the only one who can't. On the other hand, he's always been underestimated, Biden. He keeps, you know, the by-elections have kept surprising people in the sense that, you know, they keep winning Democrats. So, you know, it is possible that Biden will pull it off. But I think there's a lot of problems because you've got these third party candidate types who are really threatening, like Robert Kennedy Jr., who is really gaining traction. And he is an anti-vaccine, populist sort of, he's like a kind of Democratic version of Trump at this point. But he's getting a lot of traction, as a matter of fact. And that's a problem. And you have the Green Party candidate who, there were swing states when she ran, the same person ran against Hillary Clinton. And you know, Hillary would have lost by about 1,800 votes, and the third party candidate got 1,500 votes. I mean, these things can really matter in a really finely sliced election. So I think it's going to be a tumultuous time.
And why doesn't Biden stand down? What can't people persuade him that actually, I think you made the point that anyone except Biden might beat Trump?
You know, it's very, people don't give up power without a fight. Once the power is in your hands, I mean, ask Elizabeth II. I mean, everybody on her to ask that question. You asked Prince Charles now and said, you know what, in 5 years' time, why don't you just now give it to William and do what? I bet he won't, you know.
Danish queen.
Yeah, yes. Right, exactly. Yeah. She did, which is, I admire for it, actually. I think it was a good decision. People don't like giving up power. And I mean, you know, American, you know, the Congress is now like a gerontocracy. I mean, it's like all of these ancient people in their 80s who like run again for the another term. And you just think, when are you going to just like give them the hook? I mean, get the next generation out there. They don't. So I think there's a lot of vanity involved, honestly, in... And I think that Biden honestly thinks that he is the only person who can sort of save American democracy. And, you know, hand it to him. He won last time. And he's been really a pretty good president, actually. I mean, he's done a lot of good things and stuck to a lot of good things. There's some bad ones, too. But he's done a lot of quite good things. And the thought of a second Trump term is really alarming because he always does what he says he's going to do, which people don't seem to take seriously. I mean, he's already talking about, like, radical deportations of immigrants that, you know, sound almost like some sort of, talking about them as poisoning the blood of America. And, you know, he said, I'm going to go after the press. And I think he means it. I wouldn't at all be surprised. The people, members of the press will have to really watch out. We're sliding into an authoritarian situation where they can be absolutely harassed with lawsuits or even, heaven forfend, you know, facing prosecution of a more sort of, a scary level. So I think that it's a very alarming prospect if he does get in.
Does it look more promising in Britain, or do you think there's the same chaos there and indeed challenging of civil liberties?
Well, no, I actually don't. I mean, I think, you know, we had that moment, that very bad sort of, the Boris stretch was really a very alarming direction. I think, honestly, Keir Starmer seems like a really sort of solid, serious, old school, if you like, old type of politician, in the sense that he seems to come from a political tradition that at least, you know, I think he's very smart and very sane. I mean, I don't think that Rishi has a chance, really, but I don't think that he's horrendous. You know, we have a situation where we have in Trump, I mean, someone who breaks every, who really has, democracy hangs in the balance, you know, if Trump wins, which is a wholly different issue, I think, to the British election.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I mean, when you think about, say, Johnson against Corbyn, now they are very, very widely different visions of the world. Whereas I think, you know, to be honest, I think Starmer and Sunak could probably sit in the same cabinet if they had to.
Well, I know.
Maybe they will.
Well, maybe they will. Stranger things have happened in British politics recently. Absolutely. I mean, we have the problem of Fox News, you know. I mean, you don't have Fox News in England, and you have the BBC, and whatever people say about it, at least there are some trusted information sources. It's much, much harder here.
Well, thank you so much. You know, I realise we're probably going to lose you, but we are very, very, very grateful for your words of wisdom from the fashionable side of the Atlantic.
So thank you.
No, thank you so much. What are you working on, Andrew?
I'm doing Andrew and Fergie at the moment. Well, I'm mainly focusing on assignments trade envoy, so I think it's going to be mainly financial.
Oh, well, that'll be pretty great. I think there's a lot of you know, linen you can wash, as it were, there. And I love your books. I mean, you know, I think they're riveting. Riveting, absolutely. Love them. What about Other Andrew?
Other Andrew, Phil. Well, actually, I'm writing a book. To finish a trilogy on World War II that I've been working on for 20-odd years.
Right.
Just doing a little bit of TV work now and again. Not too many glamorous.
Are you going to sort of dramatize the book, make it a podcast or a TV?
Well, we may well do that. It's about the end of the empire, so it's quite.
Oh, that's such a good topic.
Quite meaty.
That's the big topic of our times. I always expect suddenly Meghan to say that that's what she's going to do next, and that would really be very bad news for the monarchy.
Yeah, interesting idea. Maybe I can get her to do my program.
I'd try if I were you. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Scandalmongers podcast. This has been a Podcast World production. You can get in contact with our show by emailing team@podcastworld.org, placing Scandalmongers in the heading, or via our social media links within the show's bio.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.